wondering if you could give a kind of a history of the teaching of dispensationalism in church. Basically, because I've been having conversations with someone who believes that the rapture teaching was kind of new to the church, like in the 1800s, kind of originating with the Urbanites after Edward Irving translated Coming of Messiah and Glory and Majesty into English, and that the belief is kind of goes on to say through C.I. Schofield and D.L. Moody that this became part of the teaching in the church through study Bibles.
That is a good question. You know what? Tell me again. I am your name.
Scott.
Did you say Skyler? Todd. There we go. Sorry. I have to come over here. Did you know that the way the microphones work, that you have to stand right here to hear people talk and when I get away? To repeat the question, if you didn't hear it, history of dispensationalism. I heard something about the 1800s Irving, and I heard something also about Moody. When did dispensationalism get into the church? So first of all, let's define dispensationalism. Basically, dispensationalism, there are two choices of, well, there are probably more, but there are two main schools of thoughts, ways of approaching the Bible, the interpretation, the understanding of the Bible. One school is called covenant theology. And covenant theology would be the all the Reformed churches, the Lutheran churches, the Presbyterian churches, the Anglican churches. You know, basically covenant theology and maybe the Reformed Baptist churches. And then there's dispensationalism, which, and I guess we'd put the Methodists down here, United Methodists. Dispensationalism, you mentioned Moody, has been... historically, in the last 200 years, very much in the evangelical churches, like the churches we see today that are evangelistic, evangelical churches. Now, that's just a kind of a generalization. Covenant theology believes that basically it's also called replacement theology, and the covenant theologians believe that God started with Israel. Israel was unfaithful. God is through with Israel. And God gave the promises that were made to Israel to the church. So they replace. That's why it's called replacement theology. And again, not every covenant theologian is a replacement theologian. But if you're generalizing, if you're characterizing... Covenant theology believes in the replacement of the promises to Israel. The church has replaced Israel. Dispensationalism, on the other hand, believes that Israel is a distinct entity in God's plan, not to be confused with the church, that God has separate earthly plans into the future for both entities. And so what dispensationalism is characterized by is a literal hermeneutic, a literal interpreting of the Bible, and what many covenant theologians have been characterized by is an allegorical. And an allegorical is kind of like Pilgrim's Progress. That's an allegory. Christian was a person, but he represented something else. And Faithful was a person, but he represented the faithful. And Doubting Castle represents when people are depressed. And Giant of Despair, you know what I mean? Everything means something else. And so what we come up with is we have the same Bible, the same 66 books, but the two views... Dispensationalism would say that when God promises Israel a land, that he means it, that he's giving them geographic, literal land. However, in covenant theology, and by the way, it's interesting, A little bit of this has seeped over into the charismatic movement, because the charismatics are taking a lot of promises, material promises, to Israel, and they're invoking them on the church. But what the covenant theologians would say is that the Lord is talking about the church, you know, being able to expand, and all those land promises, you know, from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt, means that the gospel will be unimpeded. And so, you know, I mean, it just sounds like it's really not anything much. However, when the Bible talked to Israel having circumcision, remember the sign of the covenant was circumcision, that every male child on the eighth day, including Jesus, were circumcised. Well, what the covenant theologians say is, well, that becomes baptism. Infant baptism. You ever wonder where infant baptism came from? You don't see it in the Bible. It's never advocated, taught. It's not in the epistles. People have to put it in the white spaces, like the jailer and his family, so there were babies. I mean, you know, and that's the only way you can get infant baptism, is to contrive it like that. But why does the covenant theologian church practice infant? Because circumcision becomes infant baptism. That's the sign of the covenant. So what you do is, you, when they're a little tiny child, just like the Israelites were circumcised, the church gets this infant baptism. So far, it just sounds like, oh, it's minor things. Okay, now, the question, let's go back to the question. Did dispensationalism come out in the 1800s, and it's just kind of through study Bibles been put on the church? Well, the essence of dispensationalism is a distinction, the essence, between Israel and the church, between a future for Israel not being the same as for the church, that God has separate plans, prophecies. That's number one. And number two, whether or not the Bible should be taken allegorically. In other words, you don't know what anything means unless you have this key to fit it in. Or primarily, literally. In other words, if the Bible says Israel is going to have this, do we interpret that to mean the church is going to do this, or do we say that the Bible does that? That the church does that, or that Israel does that, whoever it's talking about. Do we allegorize the future promises for Israel and make them the church, or do we take them literally that some are for the church and some are for Israel? So it's interesting on this, how you interpret the Bible one. I'll do that one first. I'll show you where dispensationalism started. It actually most clearly starts with Daniel. Daniel was a dispensationalist. Look at Daniel chapter 9. Daniel is studying the Bible, the same Bible we study today, those prophecies. And he says in verse 2 of chapter 9 of Daniel, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. So here is a classic example. How did people in the Bible, when they saw events that had not yet transpired, that were prophecies, how did they interpret those prophecies? How did people in the Bible, did they allegorize them and say, well, what that means is something other than what it says, or did they take them literally? So look at what he's saying here. I understood by the books the number of the years specified for the word of the Lord, that the Lord would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Israel. Now, turn back to Jeremiah, and somewhere in chapter 25, Daniel was reading. And if you go to to Jeremiah, let me see if I can find it. 25. There we go. In 11. Starting in Jeremiah 25:11. So Daniel Daniel is reading in Jeremiah what Jeremiah said is going to happen in the future to Israel. And when Daniel reads it, does Daniel take it allegorically that it means something other than it says? Or does he say it's going to literally happen this way? And this is what he read. The whole land shall be desolate in astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon. What does it say at the end of verse 11? 70 years. And so, now, Jeremiah wrote this during the beginning of the onslaught of Babylon. And so Jeremiah is alive as Nebuchadnezzar is coming through, but he said 70 years after this Babylonian deal, God's going to do something. And so he writes about it, 70 years. And it will come to pass, verse 12, when 70 years are completed, that I will punish the king of Babylon and the nation and the land of the Chaldeans for their iniquities and all that, and I will bring on that land all my words. So, and I could go through a lot in chapter 9 with you, but basically what we see is this, and this is agreed upon, even by people that are covenant theologians, that when the biblical writers, when the actual Bible writers themselves, the apostles and the prophets, when they interpreted, and by the way, Jesus too, Jesus, the Bible writers, both Old and New Testament, when they interpreted future prophecies about Israel, they never did that. They never did what is the standard operating system today. They took them, just what you saw in Daniel 9. That is a classic example that we could plod through and look at. Every time there is an Old Testament prophecy that a Bible writer interfaced with, they never allegorized it and said it must mean something other than it says. They expectantly look for it to be literally fulfilled. So, to answer this question, the history of dispensationalism, if you mean dispensationalism is talking about whether Israel is distinct from the church, the Bible has always held that. The Bible writers have always held that. In fact, the Bible is written that way. The book of Revelation, unless you allegorize it, see why the covenant theologians won't preach from Revelation? Because they don't want it to say what it says. They want it to say something else. It's the eternal fight between good and evil. They don't want to see what it says in Revelation, that God is going to, starting in chapter 7, ramp up his work with Israel, and he is sending them out, and he names them by tribes. But the covenant theologian, those tribes couldn't possibly mean the tribe of Benjamin. God's through with Israel. It couldn't be Benjamin. It must mean people that are like Paul, you know, because he was from Benjamin. And what I mean? They allegorize. They refuse to take the descriptions of what God's future plans for Israel and his future plans for the church. They don't want there to be future plans for Israel to be literal that there is a future and a hope. And that's why what's so sad is this group. Where did I write it? All the churches. Oh, here. Do you know the anti-state of Israel denominations that are always trying to divest and everything else? United Methodists are very uninterested in modern-day Israel. Reformed churches, Lutheran churches, Presbyterian churches, Anglican churches. You find any of those that think the modern-day state of Israel is a biblical miracle? Absolutely not. In fact, most Bible schools in this dimension of Christianity would rather have a Palestinian address their assembly than a Jew whose heritage is from the scriptures, who still follow the biblical feasts and the biblical everything. In fact, there's a school in Chicago, a famous one, that regularly has Palestinians address them rather than Jews, because God is done with Israel. They're cast off. Where'd that come from? Martin Luther. Martin Luther, Lutheran Church right there. One of the saddest points of his life is that he, and that's what Hitler used, Martin Luther wrote, kill the Christ killers. That's the Jews. God's through with them. There's no future for them. Kill the Christ killers. And Luther wrote that, and he was talking about difficulties with the nobility of Germany and everything else. It was a sad time in his life. But Hitler did it and used that. So back to this. If dispensationalism is defined as a literal hermeneutic, that's always been. It's not something that started in the 1800s. If dispensationalism is a distinction between Israel and the church, you can find that in the post-apostolic fathers. You can find that all the way through. There's always been. In fact, the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry has a wonderful history of dispensational ideas. But dispensationalism as a theological system with seven dispensations would be something that has been defined far earlier. But the concept, I mean, today, if I stake my life on it, I probably couldn't tell you what the seven dispensations are. I guess if I talked long enough and wrote all over the board, I'd come up with them. Because it's not knowing those seven dispensations. It's whether or not you believe that God has a future and a plan for Israel and a future and a plan for the church. And what's interesting is, and I'll just show you one more, look at chapter 15 of the book of Acts, because it's interesting that when James, a Jew, is addressing the church, he talks and he quotes actually from Amos. Again, took it literally. You know, and this is a New Testament writer talking about. And in chapter 15 at the Council in Jerusalem, he says in verse 14, Simon has declared, that's Peter, how God at the first visited the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. With this, the words of the prophets agree. Did you catch that? James is saying that the Old Testament agreed that this event was going to happen. After this, I will return and will rebuild the tabernacle, it says in 16, the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. I will rebuild its ruins, and I will set it up so the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord, who does these things. What he says is, in verse 14, Simon declared that God first visited the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. That's what was going on right then. That was post-day of Pentecost, and this is the whole thing. And then he says, but the Old Testament prophets talked about this, and they said that after this, I will return and rebuild the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. When is the church ever called the tabernacle of David? That's the Jews. See, after, what James is saying is that God had a plan for Israel. They refused his plan. He set them aside and called out for himself someone that would do what he asked. But afterward, and Amos says this, Joel says that, God says he's going to pour out his spirit, and Paul says this in chapter 9 of Romans, he's going to pour out his spirit. Romans 9 through 11, Joel 2, he's going to pour out his spirit on Israel, and that's what the whole book of Revelation is about from chapter 6 on. God restoring his plan for Israel. And James was quite aware of it. Amos quotes it. Paul describes it. Joel prophesied it. And the whole book of Revelation is about it. But if you follow the covenant theological route, you have to allegorize it all, because there's no way that those things can be true if God's done with Israel.